Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, April the 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. It's entitled, Rise of the Insects. Cicadas armed with tech, ready to take on alien bug invasion. It's written by Lauren Cross of Lee Enterprises. You've got your Swifties, your Potterheads, Trekkies, and your Whovians. But 2024 belongs to the Cicada Heads. This rare breed of fandom is poised to welcome a swarm of these alien-like bugs that are set to emerge from the earth in deafening chirps of biblical proportions across large swaths of the Midwest and southern United States. For the first time in 221 years, more than a trillion of two particular periodical cicada broods are set to surface this spring. The last time this emergence happened was in 1803, when Thomas Jefferson was president and busy finalizing the Louisiana Purchase. And mega enthusiasts like Roger McMullen, an author and self-proclaimed cicada head, are waiting with anticipation to greet the invasion. Cicada heads emerge only every so often with vigor and unmatched passion, much in line with the red-eyed insects that emerge from the earth every 13 or 17 years, McMullen said. That's one of my favorite things about the periodical cicada. It's such a weird and awesome event to have millions of these insects emerge in such a condensed area. A lot of these fans are just ecstatic, said McMullen of Lake City, Utah. The largest periodical brood set to swarm, crawl, and chirp this spring is brood XIX, which surfaces every 13 years across the southeast United States. Missouri, central and southern Illinois, Louisiana, North Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland included. Brood XIII, emerging every 17 years, has its base in the northern half of Illinois and parts of Wisconsin, Ohio, and Iowa. Together, they will provide a supercharged invasion of alien-like bugs with a pronounced and immersive sound, in some cases equivalent to the decibels of a motorcycle. Some cicadas surface annually, but periodical cicadas spend most of their lives underground. They unearth when soil temperatures hit 64 degrees to mate and lay eggs, marking the start of a new generation of that particular brood. McMullen said cicadas are most fascinating because of the predator satiation or the adaptation in which prey show up in high volumes, so far outnumbering predators that the prey survives time and time again for generations. Periodical cicadas, they basically don't have any defenses. They don't sting. They don't bite. They're not poisonous or anything like that. And so, to me, the coolest thing is, it's really, literally, like strength in numbers. Power in numbers, McMullen said. Oftentimes, people bristle at the thought of billions of cicada emerging because the mating calls can be quite loud, nearly 100 decibels, actually. That's a near equivalent to a lawnmower, chainsaw, or motorcycle. However, according to the CDC, news reports that highlight those sound comparisons alone can mislead people into believing the common myth that cicadas easily cause permanent hearing damage. The CDC says exposure duration and distance also matters. Like any loud noises, if you plan for prolonged exposure, earplugs or other noise-canceling devices are recommended, McMullen said. But the noisy presence of these bugs only seeks to fuel the enthusiastic fire of scores of people set to welcome the bugs in spectator fashion. And some scientists are counting on the help of the citizen bug groupies to track and study cicadas. Dr. Gene Kritzky, a professor emeritus of biology at Mount St. Joseph University in Ohio, has been researching cicadas for decades, including periodical brood patterns. He has high hopes that the cicada head fan base turns out this year to improve his research. Scientists like Kritzky have used crowdsourcing, a method of conducting research by involving the public with self-reported findings, for decades. Kritzky set up a hotline in 1987 to receive confirmation of sightings from people, and the volume of messages broke his answering machine. Then, in 2004, he began fielding emails from the citizen scientists and fans of the insect, telling Kritzky childhood stories and documenting the latest sightings for his research. I was getting an email a minute during business hours, six hundreds of emails on cicadas in the first day, Kritsky said. And now there's an app for that, to quote Apple. When Kritsky and Mount St. Joseph University launched the Cicada Safari cell phone app, more than 200,000 people downloaded the app and over 500,000 photographs of cicada sightings were submitted. Kritsky said he expects to exceed those numbers with this year's emergence. Users can submit video and photos of periodical cicadas to the app. Once verified, they will be added to an online map. The app greatly assists Kritsky in his research. It's available on Google Play and the Apple App Store. To learn more, check out cicadasafari.org. Crowdsourcing data about this red beady-eyed insect dates back to the 1850s, Kritsky said, but it looked quite different. In the mid-1800s, a Maryland doctor, Gideon B. Smith, had been assisting another doctor, Nathaniel Potter, researching the insect until Potter's death in 1843. Smith continued on with his research through the 1850s and 1860s. With his background working in newspapers, Smith began writing to publications all across the country, predicting when and where cicadas would next emerge. In those same letters, he requested readers to send him details on personal sightings via U.S. mail. And if he really wanted the data, he'd offer to return their stamps to them, Kritsky said. Before Smith's death in 1867, he became the first person to document every periodical brood in existence, but his name is often forgotten as he failed to publish his cicada manuscript prior to his death. In a way, the creation of Cicada Safari is a continuation of Smith's research, Kritsky said. To connect with fellow cicada heads, McMullen created a Cicadas 2024 Facebook group last spring in the lead-up to this year's once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon. There, cicada heads have posted pictures of backyard discoveries with captions like, "I cannot wait," or links to Etsy shops with custom-designed cicada t-shirts and jewelry. One fan recently asked how she could get her hands on a 1907 first edition of the periodical Cicada by C.L. Marlott, a cicada pioneer and entomologist in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And there are numerous posts from cicada heads suggesting road trips to the Midwest, specifically central Illinois, an epicenter of sorts where one brood flanks the other. Despite all his years studying periodical cicadas, Kritsky said the insect's knack for a synchronized unearthing every 13 or 17 years remains quite the mystery. How does a particular brood know when it's time to dig themselves out from underground to mate? It's got to be some kind of internal clock. We do know that they are able to detect fluid flow from the roots to the leaves in the spring, and that's how they determine how many years pass. One of the great biological mysteries is, how do they remember what year it is? Cicadas molt or shed their skin four times in their life underground, so that may help them keep track of the years, Kritsky said. Kritsky said he has fielded hundreds of calls over the years from individuals who say the cicada experience triggers childhood memories, he said. Kritsky said periodical cicadas serve as a timestamp of sorts for families stretching over multiple generations. I remember in 1987 one woman called me and said that she distinctly remembered back in 1936 a cicada landed on her brother's nose and she used a baseball bat to knock it off, breaking his nose. Several years later, she's a young mother who took out her 7-year-old daughter to watch the cicadas. 31 years later, she's talking to me. I'll bet that family, every time they see a brood X emergence, is bringing up the story about Grandma. Great, great. As a child, Roger McMullen collected insects with his father. As a senior in high school, his love for cicadas ramped up. Last year, McMullen dressed up as a cicada and his son as a young cicada for Halloween, further solidifying his ranking as a hardcore cicada head. Now he has created a fun way of introducing curious school-aged children to the insect with McMullen's graphic novel, Cicadapocalypse, due out this spring. It's even been vetted by educators, entomologists, and children's authors. He describes it as a thrilling graphic novel about squirrels, fae, a prepper, and Cyrus, a foodie, as they try to escape an onslaught of periodical cicadas. Throughout the story, facts about the periodical cicadas are sprinkled throughout the narrative, making it an immersive and educational read that's ideal for the cicada-curious elementary and middle school reader, according to crowdfunder website. McMillan said the book's fun narrative also helps children confront their fears with the unknown. Education is the best way to combat fear, he said. In the book, a lot of people are scared. It's a cicada invasion, and so they're terrified, he said. But throughout the book, the main character discovers that, oh, lo and behold, cicadas are actually awesome, a great food source. And so that's the hope in this education journey, that those who read it also learn that cicadas are awesome. Next is an article entitled Davenport Man Charged with CL Man's 2022 Murder. It's written by Jeff Reinitz of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Dateline is Cedar Falls. A Davenport man has been charged in a 2022 fatal shooting in Cedar Falls that claimed the life of a Clear Lake resident. Beau Bradley Ekstrom, age 31, is charged with first-degree murder, felon in possession of a firearm, and intimidation with a weapon. He was transferred to the Blackhawk County Jail on Monday after he was released from prison on unrelated charges. Authorities allege Ekstrom was one of the people involved in the February 6, 2022 shooting on College Street that resulted in the death of 19-year-old Arthur Craig Lang of Clear Lake. Prosecutors described that incident as a chance encounter between two groups that didn't know each other that erupted in gunfight around closing time in the College Hill area. According to court records, Ekstrom and a friend were standing in the area of the G parking lot in the 2200 block of College Street around 1:45 a.m. An SUV containing Lang and others from the Mason City Clear Lake area pulled up to the two. Holtz began talking to people in the vehicle, and at some point shooting broke out with Ekstrom firing at people in the vehicle. Lang was hit and driven to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Holt was also injured by gunfire and suffered a partially severed spine, according to police. Ekstrom fled and hid his handgun, which investigators later found, records state. They also found seven spent shell casings where he had been standing during the shooting. One of the people from the vehicle, Brandon Javon Mitchell, was arrested for attempted murder, intimidation with a weapon, and prohibited person in possession of a firearm. His trial is tentatively scheduled for July. Another, Daniel Martez Judon IV, pleaded to intimidation with a weapon and was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison. Court records show Ekstrom has prior convictions in Scott County for lascivious acts with a child, failure to register as a sex offender, and criminal mischief for damaging his GPS monitoring device. Our final story from the front page of the Globe Gazette today, site plan for distribution center south of Mason City approved. This is written by Robin McClellan. A new distribution center warehouse will be coming to Mason City South Side. A site plan for Seafried Industrial Properties proposed 49,950 square foot distribution center on 43rd Street Southwest and South Washington Avenue was approved by the Mason City Planning and Zoning Board of Adjustment on March the 5th. The site is adjacent to the Iowa State Patrol District Office. On Tuesday, the board approved a variance allowing Seafried to place a commercial parking area on the north portion of the facility that encroaches 5.2 feet into the 10-foot setback allowed for parking. The lot is necessary for distribution vehicles, according to the company. Seafried Industrial Properties builds and manages to suit properties for companies such as Best Buy, Ace Hardware, and Amazon. It specializes in distribution centers such as the proposed development on South Washington Avenue and has developed properties across the United States. We have approved a site plan for a distribution center on South Washington, said Planning and Zoning Manager Tricia Sandall in an email. We do not know who will be operating the distribution center. In a report to the council, staff wrote, "The applicant proposed to construct a distribution center on the subject property. The site improvements include a 49,950 square foot building, an employee parking lot, a parking lot for distribution vehicles, and a large area of on-site stormwater detention. With the exception of the parking lot for the commercial vehicles, the development conforms to the zoning ordinance. It is unclear when construction is set to begin, as closing on the land is still underway. Top story on the local page is entitled Council Approves Liquor License for Northside Liquor, also written by Robin McClelland. A North Iowa liquor store will see at least a 12-month stay of its liquor license after previously being denied a renewal. Mason City Council approved a liquor license for Northside Liquor, 1303 North Federal Avenue, owned by Zane Properties on Tuesday night. In November, the council denied a request for a license renewal request in the name of a manager of the business. At the time, Mason City Police Department Chief Jeff Brinkley stated that the application was a workaround by the business after the Alcoholic Beverages Division had instituted sanctions for violations of alcoholic beverage laws. Councilman Paul Adams asked the April 2nd meeting if the renewal could be restricted due to the issues the city has encountered with Northside's business practices in the past. Brinkley deferred to Deputy City Clerk Diana Black, who said the city has the option to use a 6-month license, but had not used it in the past. Councilman William Simons clarified that the ABD would be unable to continue its investigations into the violations reported by Northside Liquor if they did not hold a current license. Adams had noted at the November meeting there had been 23 complaints against the liquor store made by parents, neighbors, and the ADB itself, along with a confession obtained from a driver accused of operating while intoxicated, which stated they had made an illegal purchase at the store. Brinkley concurred that by approving the license now, ABD would continue its investigation, and as the regulatory authority would hand down any consequences from its inquiry directly to Northside Liquor. The council approved the license renewal for another 12 months. Next is an article by Jacob Schaefer entitled Mason City Motorcyclist Dies After Colliding with Deer. A Mason City man died after colliding with a deer on his motorcycle early Sunday morning. A Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's deputy located the crash near the 1300 block of Broad Street in Plymouth just before 4:30 a.m. on March 31st. Law enforcement identified Alan Schaefer, age 22, as the operator of the motorcycle. According to a sheriff's report, Schaefer was traveling northbound on Broad Street when he struck a deer that entered the roadway. Paramedics were on the scene where Schaefer was pronounced dead. The Mason City Police Department, Mason City Fire Department, and the Plymouth Fire Department assisted on the scene. And Governor Reynolds signs new Iowa Religious Freedom Bill into law. Critics call it cover for discrimination. It's written by Tom Barton of the Globe Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday signed into law a measure supporters say will strengthen protections for religious expressions in Iowa. Opponents contend it would give legal cover to discriminate against LGBTQ Iowans and others. Reynolds signed Senate File 2095 into law during a closed-door event hosted by the Christian conservative group The Family Leader. 30 years ago, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed almost unanimously at the federal level. Since then, religious rights have increasingly come under attack, Reynolds said in a statement. Today, Iowa enacts a law to protect these unalienable rights, just as 26 other states have done, upholding the ideals that are the very foundation of our country. Under the new law, state and local government shall not substantially burden someone's exercise of religion unless it is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and must be narrowly tailored in the least restrictive means of pursuing that interest. A person, corporation, church, foundation, or other entity whose exercise of religion has been burdened would have the power to go to court to seek damages, injunctive relief, or other legal recourse. The bill defines exercise of religion as action substantially motivated by one's sincerely held religious belief, whether or not the exercise is compulsory or central to a larger system of religious beliefs. Supporters say the bill is needed because, in their view, U.S. Supreme Court rulings have eroded religious freedom protections that were passed into federal law in 1993 by a Democrat majority Congress and signed by Democratic President Bill Clinton. The federal law applies only to the federal government, but at least 24 states have passed state-level versions of the legislation. House Democrats warned the bill would lead to state-sanctioned discrimination against LGBTQ plus Iowans and denial of reproductive health care, using religious freedom as a defense. Democrats introduced an amendment defeated by Republicans that would have inserted into the bill protections against discrimination as prescribed in the Iowa Civil Rights Act. The amendment aimed to restore the original purpose of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act while preventing its misuse to erode civil rights and sidestep non-discrimination laws. Others said the bill would undermine inclusivity and harm Iowa's economy, making it harder for Iowa businesses to recruit workers from out of state and retain current residents. Several business groups and chambers of commerce were registered opposed to the bill, including Krauss Group, the Technology Association of Iowa, Principal Financial Group, and the Iowa Chamber Alliance. Representative Steve Holtz, a Republican from Denison and a lead sponsor of the bill, called the arguments against the bill hyperbolic and misinformed during floor debate. Holt said the bill protects religious freedom in a narrow way and requires a balancing test by courts when evaluating restrictions on religious freedom. Representative Charlie Thompson, a Republican from Charles City, said the legislation does not mean that a religious claimant is going to win. It just means that they're going to get a hearing and a balancing test, Thompson said during debate on the bill. Connie Ryan, executive director of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, in a statement upon the bill's passage, said religious freedom is already protected under the Iowa and U.S. constitutions. There's no rationale for legislation that misuses religious freedom as a means to justify discrimination against others, Ryan said. No person should be allowed to use their faith to impose their beliefs on another person or to take away their rights. Next up is an article entitled Stebbins to Present Monty Python's Spamalot, written by Robin McClelland of the Globe Gazette. Many people are likely familiar with Ensemble Monty Python's satirical brand of mildly subversive sketch comedy. Now, actors at Stebbins Children's Theater in Mason City are producing the hit musical Spamalot, based on the 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Originally brought to the stage in 2005, the show is a compilation of memorable scenes from the film. This production features 10 performers who are high school seniors and a cast of 40 students. Anne Marie Hansen, Bryn Christensen, and Alex Shipman are all veterans to the Stebbins stage who are keen to put on this fast, funny comedy. All the scenes are funny, says Christensen. It's written by sketch comedians, so it's very different from most plays. Director Tom Ballmer says the show features some outstanding props and sets. There are some big set pieces this time around. It's a good show. Christensen worked behind the scenes on choreography as well as on her performance as the Lady of the Lake. She worked in part with fellow classmate Mark Bradley, who choreographed a song as well. Shipman has been in 30 performances at Stebbins. My favorite song in this show is Knights of the Round Table. It's 6 minutes long and has 8 different dance moves. It's fun, he said. Hansen, Christensen, and Shipman have performed together in past shows, and while each has a favorite performance, they all agreed the production of Oliver Jr. was an all-time favorite. Tickets for Monty Python's Spamalot are available at the Stebbins Children's Theater box office, 616 North Delaware Avenue, by calling area code 641-424-9802 or online at stebbinschildrentheater.cssticks.com. Showtimes are 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. April 6th and April 14th and 7 p.m. April 7th, 10th through 12th, and 16th through 17th. Osage Robotics Team earns spot in World Championships. Green Devils also awarded Rookie All-Star Award. This is written by Jason W. Selby for the Globe Gazette. The Osage Community High School Robotics Team competed in the Iowa Regional First Robotics Competition in Cedar Falls last month and was one of only two teams to earn a spot in the first World Championships in Houston. Around 60 teams from across the Midwest competed in Cedar Falls, along with teams from Brazil and China. In order to participate in an event like this, it takes the whole community working together, Osage coach and mentor David Olympia said. We can't raise enough money every year just by grants. At first, rural teams such as Osage often face large city and suburban competition. Despite this, Osage was one of only two teams to earn a spot in the first World Championships in Houston. With help from the community, Osage would compete from April 17th through 20th. Even more impressive, this was Osage's first year as the program did not start until last fall. Osage was awarded the Rookie All-Star Award for their trouble. It is a huge accomplishment and a lot to take in, said Jeff Margaret, First Robotics Competition Regional Director. In a press release, Osage Community High School noted that competition costs and expenses are significant, and as Lempia explained, only with help from the community will the Green Devils be able to compete. Kayla Parks was one of the members of the Osage Robotics team that took a victory lap at the March 25th Osage Community School Board meeting. Going in, you don't expect it to be such a big event, Parks said. It was a big event with a big result. Parks indicated the team was willing to hold fundraisers to help raise the money needed to head to Houston in April. If they can do that, their future is set. We have quite a few future plans for the team, Parks said. The sky's the limit, says Osage Community School District Superintendent Barb Schwarman. And Mason City IJAG students attend career conference. Students from the Mason City area who are part of the Iowa Jobs for America's Graduates program attended a statewide conference for career learning, guidance, and employment last week, according to a press release. On March 28th, IJAG hosted workshops, competitions, and a career fair with employers during the Career Development Conference presented by the Wellmark Foundation. The 25th annual CDC was held in Des Moines with nearly 600 Iowa high school students in attendance. The event featured more than 55 Iowa-based employers who provided mentorship and education to youth about career pathways, along with opportunities for work-based learning. Among others, employers included Wellmark, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Marshalltown Community College, CJ Bio, Hy-Vee, and Georgia Pacific. The Wellmark Foundation is proud to support the amazing work of IJAG in shaping the future of our youth, said Laura J. Jackson, Executive Vice President of Health Equity, Access, and Improvement in the release and Chair of the Wellmark Foundation Board of Directors. IJAG provides unparalleled guidance to students throughout their academic journey, empowering them to graduate high school and pursue higher education and employment opportunities that are vital for our kids to live a long, healthy life. Together, IJAG and the Wellmark Foundation are committed to creating a brighter, more prosperous future for our youth, one student at a time. Today, I spoke to 30 to 40 employers about career options, said Mason City High School student Ellie Authier in a statement. I learned there is so much opportunity in the workforce and people that are willing to put me on the path to getting there. The graduation rate for IJAG students is 7% higher than students who are not in the program, which is a reflection of employer engagement with youth, according to IJAG leaders. Together, partnerships with employers and local school districts through IJAG are aiding in the immediate fulfillment of jobs, talent pipeline development, economic growth, and workforce solutions. We have a few obituaries in the Globe Gazette today. First, we remember Margaret Ann Chisholm, age 91, who died Saturday, March 30th, 2024, at the Manly Specialty Care Center. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Monday, April the 8th, 2024, at Bride Colonial Chapel, 110 East Spring Street in Manly, Iowa, with Pastor Linda Johnson Prestholt officiating. Burial will be in the Plymouth Cemetery at a later date. And we remember Anna C. Niles, 89, of Mason City, who died Sunday, March 31st, 2024, at the Manly Specialty Care Home in Manly. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April the 5th, 2024, at Bethlehem Lutheran Church, Mason City. Officiating will be Reverend Jesse Burns. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Fullerton Funeral Home, 123 2nd Street Southeast, Mason City. Interment will be in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Those wishing to make a donation may do so to the Humane Society of North Iowa. And we remember Alan J. Schaefer, age 22, of Mason City, who passed away Sunday, March 31st, 2024. Funeral services would be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April the 6th, 2024, at Rhythm Church, 21 8th Street Southeast. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, also at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family of Alan Schaefer. Online condolences may be left for the family at majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City, 641-423-0924 or www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. And in high school girls soccer, Mason City embracing big expectations this season. It's written by Nate Thomas. Expectations have never been higher for Mason City girls soccer. After finishing last season with 16 wins and 3 losses and one game away from the state tournament, with the attacking talent the Riverhawks had all coming back, there's plenty of reason to think this team could get over the hump. So far in 2 games, Mason City has looked like that team and managed the pressure well. In the home opener on Tuesday, the Riverhawks defeated Humboldt 10-0. It came a night after a season-opening 7-1 win over Waterloo West on the road. Both matches were splendid performances to start the season, but Coach Shannon Dykstra said the team is more focused on getting better every day, not just the results from the season's first few contests. "We have a team with some expectations, and we have to handle those expectations and handle them the right way," he said. "We are just trying to stay focused and get better at one or two things each day. If the wins come, the wins come." Unique and fresh superlatives are running out for the forwards for Mason City. Karma McMorris scored a hat trick on Tuesday to lead the scoring for the Riverhawks. The junior was All-State a season ago after finishing with 42 goals. Kenna Heman, and Reggie Spots, who both more than 20 goals last year, found the back of the net, as did senior Claudia Sewell, who had a hat trick of her own in the win over Waterloo West. So far, the attacking prowess has delivered as it was expected to from the beginning of the season. "We have some true footballers on this team that love the game, and they have a lot of fun playing it," Dykstra said. "They work really hard on our culture. We have kids who love the game that make it a good place to be. That's what we want." For as veteran and experienced as the forwards are on the team, it's the complete opposite for the defense and backline for the Riverhawks this season. Annika Bjunglin and Elizabeth Ondama, two senior midfielders, are helping to bring along a defense that returns just a group of players that made just 11 starts last season. Maya Anderson is the leader in that group with 8. Isabel Hardy made 2 but played under 100 minutes all season in goal, and Allison Brandt had just 1. It's a strong mix of junior talent and underclassmen amongst those vying for playing time this season. They are all competing hard, and they are eager to learn, which is important. "We just have to remember that we have a lot more to teach," Dykstra said. "We are developing relationships and trying to figure out partnerships back there. We ask them to be flexible, and we are going to find a combination that works." Even with a mix of inexperienced players and the ones returning that are trying to reach heights, Mason City has not before. It's the same level of play from everyone. "That has been the best part," Dykstra said, "is that the team is not shying away from the lofty expectations and goals set for themselves." The schedule picks up next week with 4 matches, the first against Denver. The Cyclones are one of the best teams in Class 1A this season. Dykstra said this is the early test to see if Mason City is really up for the challenge. "This is the challenge they want," he said. "They have spent their lives playing soccer, and if you want to be in positions like this where you are relevant on a state level, we have to embrace it." That's going to do it for today's Globe Gazette. Now we'll turn over to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Our top story there is entitled, "County Attorney, Fort Dodge Officers Were Justified in Shooting. March 16th Incident Left One Man Dead." It's written by Bill Shea. 4 Fort Dodge police officers were justified in using force during a March 16th incident that ended with the fatal shooting of 24-year-old Tyler C. Stansberry, Webster County Attorney Darren Driscoll has ruled. Officer Nick Ruggles, Sergeant Matthew Webb, Officer Andrew Lane, and Officer Matthew English were each justified in the use of reasonable force, including deadly force, in that each reasonably believed that such force was necessary to defend himself or another from an actual or imminent use of unlawful force by Tyler C. Stansberry, Driscoll wrote in a report released Wednesday. Driscoll identified English as the officer who fired the fatal shots. He reported that English fired two rounds that hit Stansberry in the torso. The county attorney's report provides details of the quick, deadly confrontation between Stansberry and the four officers in a cramped area at the bottom of the basement stairs at 1525 4th Avenue South. Driscoll wrote that Stansberry charged at the officers from a dark room with a knife in each hand. He wrote that a taser and a beanbag round were also fired at Stansberry. All four officers have been on critical incident leave since March 16th. They will be returning to duty shortly. The officers were dispatched to 1525 4th Avenue South at 8:40 a.m. March 16th in response to reports that a man there was out of control and had injured a dog. Officers spoke to family members outside the house. According to Driscoll, they learned that Stansberry was in an agitated state and had been punching a dog. They were told that he was pacing around in the basement. They also learned from their dispatcher that there was a warrant for Stansberry's arrest for violation of probation. He had been placed on probation for an earlier domestic abuse conviction. The officers then entered the house. Ruggles, holding a shield and a taser, led the way down the stairs, calling, "Tyler, Tyler, come talk to us, man." English was next in the line, followed by Lane, who had a shotgun loaded with a beanbag round intended to be non-lethal. Webb brought up the rear. The officers checked a bathroom near the bottom of the stairs and found no one inside. According to Driscoll's report, Ruggles then called out, "Tyler, Kyler, come over here." The officers heard a scream and Stansberry came running towards them from a darkened room to their left. Driscoll wrote, he wrote that Stansberry had a knife in each hand. Ruggles, English, and Lane fired their weapons, Driscoll wrote. Webb, who was still on the staircase, didn't fire his. Stansberry fell at the feet of the officers. Even though he was wounded, he still resisted as the officers took away the knives, Driscoll wrote. After the knives were taken away, an ambulance was called. Next is an article entitled Monkey Named 2024 Frontier Days Grand Marshal, Former Councilman Honored for Community Service, also written by Bill Shea. Dr. Terry Monkey is accustomed to seeing individuals and families coming into his optometry office for their appointments. Bigger groups of people coming in are something he is not accustomed to. "I always get nervous when people walk in that door in groups," he said Wednesday afternoon. So when about seven people came in together Wednesday afternoon, he may have been a bit suspicious. There was no need to be concerned. The group consisted of representatives of the Frontier Days Committee and the Fort Museum and Frontier Village. They were there to inform him that he had been chosen as the 2024 Frontier Days Grand Marshal to honor him for his long history of service to the community. He and his wife Pam were presented with dark blue Stetson hats similar to those once worn by cavalry troopers. Monkey said he was surprised. The Frontier Days Committee had selected him as their Grand Marshal late last year and even considered announcing it during his last city council meeting in December. Monkey represented Ward 1 on the council from 2013 to 2023. During that time, he pushed for riverfront improvements, infrastructure upgrades on the city's northwest side, and the establishment of the municipal broadband utility called Fort Dodge Fiber. He also started the Backpack Buddies program that provides qualifying school children with nutritious food to eat on the weekends. The program got its name from the fact that the food used to be placed in a backpack for students. Monkey also led the creation of the Veteran Memorial Park along Badger Lake that features trees planted in memory of veterans, various markers and memorials, and an amphitheater where the community's Memorial Day services are held. It is now called Terry Monkey Veterans Memorial Park. This year's Frontier Day celebration will be held May 31st through June the 2nd. "I think it's a good tradition that we need to uphold," Monkey said. Frontier Days, he said, creates memories that will last a lifetime. Now we come to an article on the front page of the Messenger entitled "Statesmen Will Perform with FDSH Choir Members." It's written by Chris Johnson. Fort Dodge choir students will get a chance to be in a college chorus for one night. The Iowa State University Statesmen, under the direction of James Rode, will present a concert with the FDSH Fortis Quorum, a bass clef choir. The concert will be held at the Fort Dodge Middle School Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. today. There will be no cost for admission because of a donation of the Dwight and Marilyn Conover Foundation. It is such a unique and exciting opportunity for our students to experience this performance and to perform and collaborate with statesmen to inspire their interest in continuing to sing after high school, said Fort Dodge Senior High School Choir Director Matt Dress. The Fortis Quorum will open the concert, and all of the combined tenor bass singers at FDSH will perform in collaboration with the statesmen to finish the show. The nationally renowned ensemble will be highlighted by 2023 Fort Dodge graduate Braden Schmider. "I'm so excited to sing for my hometown again," Schmider said. This group is about 70 guys, all from different majors around campus. The Statesman Ensemble is a distinguished low-voice vocal group known for its musicality and captivating performances. "Having a Fort Dodge alum from the choir program to return and perform in our community is so exciting," Dries says. Braden was deeply invested in choir and musicals at FDSH, and for him to continue singing in college and to perform in Fort Dodge with his college ensemble is incredibly exciting. "Their ensemble showcases a diverse repertoire spanning various musical genres. We have performed mainly in Ames, but had a few concerts in other places like Des Moines and LaPorte City," Schmider said. "It has been so much fun being a part of this choir and being under the direction of Dr. Rode. I can't wait for everyone to hear what Statesman has been working on this past year." Next up, Ag Day held at SCC Middle School. Students get a glimpse of diverse careers. Dateline is Rockwell City. Some kids got to take field trips to farms. Others read books about food and farming through ag in the classroom. Students at South Central Calhoun Middle School in Rockwell City learned more about ag careers on March 21st through Ag Day, which is coordinated by the Calhoun County Farm Bureau Board and Calhoun County Extension and Outreach. This annual event alternates between the middle schools in Rockwell City and Manson each spring. It's designed to show students the wide variety of careers in agriculture in the local area and beyond. Just like farmers plant seeds to grow a crop, Ag Day plants seeds for the students to guide their future, even if they don't know today what career they will pursue, said James Hepp, president of the Calhoun County Farm Bureau. "We show the kids that there are many good ag-related jobs here close to home." Throughout the school day, a variety of local presenters, including Calhoun County Farm Bureau directors and other ag professionals, gave the students an inside look at veterinary medicine, livestock production, international ag, agronomy, grain management, ag lending, and other careers. Students carried a worksheet with them during the school day and wrote down three things they learned from each presenter. They were also encouraged to participate in each session and ask questions. A highlight of the day included the hamburgers the Calhoun County cattlemen grilled for the students for lunch. The Calhoun County Farm Bureau directors were pleased to hear many positive comments from SCC teachers about 2024 Ag Day event. Some short articles under the In Brief heading. First, threat at FDMS investigated. A bomb threat directed at the Fort Dodge Middle School Wednesday afternoon remains under investigation. No bombs were found during a methodical search of the building by about 25 law enforcement officers. At this time, there is no reason to believe that the physical safety of any student or staff was ever in danger, Police Chief Dennis Quinn said in a written statement. At 2:54 p.m., the police department's school resource officer was notified of the threat to the school at 800 North 32nd Street. The threat was received very near the end of the school day, and the building was quickly emptied. The search was then conducted by Fort Dodge Police, Webster County Sheriff's Deputies, the Iowa State Patrol, and Webster County Emergency Management. Anyone with information about this incident is asked to call the police department at 515-573-1424. They can also contact Webster County Crime Stoppers at 515-573-1444. online at wccrimestoppers.com or by texting LEC to 274-637. Friends of KYL fundraiser Monday, Dateline Webster City, backed by popular demand, Friends of the Kendall Young Library will be hosting a whiskey and wine fundraiser at the Wildcat Distilling Company, 626 2nd Street in Webster City from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday. This event will offer a variety of appetizers, drinks, and homemade desserts. Tickets are required and can be purchased for $50 at Kendall Young Library, Webster City. Tickets available. Ticket availability is limited to 50. And Brushy Creek Solar Eclipse Hike Monday, Dateline Duncombe. Brushy Creek State Recreation Area is holding a solar eclipse hike at 1:30 p.m. Monday. Experience the partial solar eclipse while enjoying views of Brushy Creek Lake. Meet at the West Trail Bridge parking lot, 2554 Union Avenue, Duncombe. Some viewing glasses will be available, or bring your own. And bodies of 6 foreign aid workers slain in Israeli strikes are transported out of Gaza, Dateline of Rafah of the Gaza Strip. The bodies of 6 foreign aid workers killed in Israeli airstrikes began the journey back to their home countries Wednesday as the more questions swirled over Israel's explanation that a misidentification led to the attack on their convoy. The deadly strikes renewed criticism of Israel's conduct in the nearly six-month war with Hamas and highlighted the risks that the military's bombardment poses to aid workers as they try to deliver food to the besieged enclave. The UN says nearly a third of the Gaza population is on the brink of starvation. The three British citizens, a Polish citizen, an Australian, and a Canadian-American dual citizen, worked for the World Central Kitchen, an international charity founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres. Now we'll read today's obituaries from the Messenger. First, Marilyn Carlson, age 70, of Stratford, passed away April the 1st, 2024, at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska, after a hard-fought battle with liver disease. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, April the 8th, at the Stratford Evangelical Lutheran Church in Stratford. Visitation will be Sunday, April the 7th, from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the church. For the full obituary, visit www.fosterfuneralandcremation.com. Next, we remember Craig D. Spud Vogt of Livermore. Funeral will take place 11 a.m. Friday, April the 5th. Visitation Thursday, April the 4th, 5 to 7 p.m., both at Mason Lindhart Funeral Home. Burial in Union Cemetery, Humboldt. For more information, you can go to www.masonlindhart.com. And we remember Sandra Switer, age 69, of Britt, who passed away on Monday, April the 1st, at her home. More information can be found at www.ewingfh.com. We remember Weston Lee Douglas, the son of Brandon and Alexis Douglas of Kanawha, who was born silently on March 22, 2024, at Mercy One Northwest Iowa Medical Center. More information can be found at www.ewingfh.com. And we remember Elizabeth Bowman of Ankeny, who died on April the 3rd, 2024. Visitation April 4th from 5 to 7 at Bowman Funeral Home, www.bowmanfh.com. That's in Webster City. Funeral April the 5th, 11 a.m., First Baptist Church in Forest City. Now we remember Kenneth Froh, F-R-O-H, age 69, of Clarion, formerly of Webster City, who died April the 3rd, 2024, at the Clarion Wellness and Rehab. More information can be found at www.gundersonfuneralhome.com. And finally, we remember Jane Olson of Williams, who passed away on April the 1st, 2024 at Southfield Wellness Community. Jane was 90 years old. Services are pending with honor. Adam's celebration of life is serving the family. Now it's time for sports, and we'll start with an article entitled McKinney Ready to Give Back in Webster City. This is written by Dana Becker. For Taylor McKinney, a simple lesson taught years ago ultimately led her into a new business adventure. McKinney, a Webster City High School and Iowa Central graduate, has started T-Money Elite Basketball Training as a way to help youth players improve their all-around skills. As someone who spent countless hours in the gym herself growing up, McKinney wants to provide the same kind of support and services to the next generation. The reason why I chose to start my own basketball skills workout is because I want to grow the game in the community, McKinney said. Once I graduated from Webster City, I've always wanted to put together a way where I can help individuals grow a passion for the game, but haven't been able to do that as I spent my freshman and sophomore year of college playing basketball at Iowa Central. I wanted to find just the right time where my full attention will be focused on basketball and growing the love for the game, which happens to be this coming summer. Plans are in place for two camps to be held, with one for boys and girls in grade 3 through 6, and the other for grades 7 through 12. The first will focus on all aspects of the game to get kids interested in the sport. I fell in love with the game at a very young age, McKinney said. I remember going to camps myself that got me interested in continuing to play as I grew up. The focus of the other camp will be on the offensive side of basketball. As a Lynx standout, McKinney scored a school record 1,340 points with 469 made field goals and 188 made three-pointers. I want to instill in them that the more work you do outside of the season, the more it'll show during the season, she said. As I started my playing career for AAU at All Iowa Attack, they would always tell us to go pick up a ball outside of practices, and that's what I would do. I would go to the gym many times, having my dad, former WCHS boys basketball coach Marty McKinney, rebound for me just to get shots up. That grew my game tremendously over my career. I want to give those age groups the tools to be a better all-around offensive player, not just shooting. Individual and small group workouts will also be offered around the camps. My dad and current Webster City Activities Director Jess Howard have been great help on helping me get all this set up, as they both have been huge mentors in my life all throughout my playing careers, both in basketball and softball. McKinney said, I'm excited to start this new opportunity, and all the information to come will be posted on the Facebook page, T-Money's Elite Basketball Training. Next, Fort Dodge hopes to continue its rugby momentum. Stags build momentum from third-place state effort a year ago. This is written by Eric Pratt. The Fort Dodge Rugby Club has had a memorable 2023 campaign, reaching the state field and placing third for the first time in program history. Head coach Tom McClyman recognizes his squad is in a bit of transition period after graduating a large and talented senior class. The Stags aren't backing down from the challenge of turning this into a season of reloading rather than rebuilding, though. When you lose a group of seniors that we had last year, there's just a natural void in leadership, said McClyman, who is in his sixth season at the helm. At the start, I wasn't sure who exactly was going to step up, but as the year has gone on, the team has really come together. We still have some work to do and are still looking for a true leader on the field, but things are heading in the right direction. Fort Dodge opened its spring campaign with a split last Friday at Central Springs. The Stags defeated Waverly Shell Rock 17-12 and lost to Cedar Falls 15-7. McClyman believes Fort Dodge's trademark toughness will again be on display in 2024. The Stags are far from a finished product. McClyman sees plenty of areas that need to be shored up in the immediate future. Need to do a little better job of staying connected on defense to avoid overloads leading to big plays, McClyman said. We got burned a couple of times last year. Offensively, we need to work on finding our structure and moving the ball sideline to sideline. We also need to recognize when it's time to go fast and when it's time to slow down. All those things will improve through better communication. Fort Dodge continues to embrace the rugby culture as it grows both the boys and girls programs. I think we're doing a good job, McClyman said. We added a women's team. We have 30 kids out this year on the boys' side, and we are hoping to get a youth league going this summer. Those are all positive steps, but we are still looking to win a title. We got third last season, which was great, but we're still working to get to the big game. In their opening matches, Elias, Adams, Peterson, and Fershing all had tries. Elias was 3-for-4 on conversion kicks. The Stags face Valley at 6:50 p.m. and Southeast Polk at 8:10 p.m. on Friday in West Des Moines. Their home invitational is May the 3rd. McClyman is again assisted by Corey Peterman. Former players Dalton Rosales, Keaton Nichols, Colin Munter, and Orion Larson-Trott are also on the staff this spring. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments or concerns about this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.